As an aside, what it reminds me of is the time my older brother took me to the ice skating pond behind the hospital in Port Huron, Michigan. I was probably 4 years old, which made of him 8. We were ice skating, and then I got tired and we sat on a log. Some bad boys were throwing snowballs that had rocks in them, and one hit me on the head, but I didn't feel anything until my brother looked at me and he said, "Toddy, you're bleeding!" And I went, "Ah!" and cried, and we went home. It was 4 blocks to home, and my mother said, "What did you do to her?" All turned out all right. Sometimes the memories that we have of our mothers are guilty ones, memories of times when we as children exploited the intense love of our mother. Tobias Wolff tells such a story in his book, This Boy's Life, a memoir. In 1955, 10-year-old Toby and his divorced mother were driving across Colorado to Salt Lake City to start a new life. Their Nash Rambler, oh yes, I remember those, boiled over just after they crossed the Continental Divide. While they were waiting for it to cool, they heard from somewhere above them the bawling of an air horn. The sound got louder, and then a big truck came around the corner and shot past them into the next curve. They stared after it. "Oh, Toby," his mother said, "he's lost his brakes." The sound of the horn grew distant, then faded. They drove on until they came to a place where the truck had gone off the road. Quite a few people were standing along the cliff. The truck had smashed through the guardrails and fallen hundreds of feet through empty space to the river below, where it lay on its back among the boulders. A stream of black smoke rose from the cab. Toby's mother asked whether anyone had gone to report the accident, and someone had. They stood with the others on the cliff's edge. Nobody spoke. His mother put her arm around Toby's shoulder. For the rest of the day, she kept looking over at him, touching him, brushing back his hair. Tobias Wolff wrote, "I saw that the time was right to make a play for souvenirs." I knew she had no money for them, and I had tried not to ask. But now that her guard was down, I couldn't help myself. When we pulled out of Grand Junction, I owned a beaded Indian belt, beaded moccasins, and a bronze horse with a removable tooled leather saddle. Each of us have our own memories of our childhood. Sometimes an adult tried hard to care for us, but did not know enough to provide the right kind of help. The writer, Eileen Simpson, lost her mother when she was 2 months old and her father when she was 5. Eileen Simpson's aunt, a teacher and later a school principal in New York City, raised Eileen. In a memoir describing her childhood growing up with dyslexia, Reversals, a personal account of victory over dyslexia, she wrote about how her aunt tried to help her learn to read. She said, "There seemed to be nothing I could do to please Auntie. With a feeling of impending doom, I would begin. I might get halfway through the first sentence before Auntie would say in a dry, controlled voice, 'In the context, the word cannot possibly be saw. The man saw going home. Does that make sense to you? It must be was.'" 9-year-old Eileen would repeat, "The man was going home." In the next sentence, or the one after, she would meet the word again and hesitate. Had she said was before and had her aunt corrected it to say saw or vice versa? Eileen struggled as her dyslexic brain scrambled the order of the letter W-A-S. Her aunt would say, "Don't tell me you don't recognize that word. I just told it to you. You're not trying. How can you be so stupid? The word is was. So often we parents want to do the right thing, for example, to teach our children to read. We do our best, but we do not know what is going on inside our children's heads. As an aside, my second oldest brother, Jock, has dyslexia. And my mother, they didn't know really what it was back then. This would have been 70-some years ago. But he couldn't read in first grade. He was struggling and struggling with reading. And finally, my mother was called in, and they said, "He's going to amount to nothing. You might as well have him institutionalized." And my mother, as was her wont, Don't tell her what she can't do, and don't tell her what her children can't do. And my brother grew up to be president of a major bank in Chicago and is very successful, and he is a voliferous reader. Another area where we parents are less than perfect is when we involve our children in our family fights. Russell Baker, in his memoir, Growing Up, describes the power struggle between his mother and her mother-in-law, who lived across the street from each other in a small town in Virginia. It was in the 1930s. His grandmother thought his mother kept the 6-year-old Russell under too much discipline. One afternoon, grandmother took him down into the cellar pantry to feed him on her, and then said, slicing a thick piece for each of them, she put on a coat of butter, and then said, you want jelly on top of it? Oh, yes, ma'am, please, said little Russell. She took a jar from the shelf and removed the wax and had the knife poised to plunge in when they were caught. Russell, what are you doing down there? His mother was silhouetted in the doorway. Grandma's fixing me a piece of jelly bread. Russell's mother spoke to her mother-in-law. You know I don't want him eating between meals. Her voice was terrible with anger. So was grandmother. Are you going to tell me how to raise a boy? I'm telling you, I don't want him eating jelly bread between meals. He's my child, and he'll do as I tell him. Don't you come in here telling me how to raise my children. I raised a dozen children, and not one of them ever dared raise their voice to me like you do. Little Russell cowered between them while the shouting rose, but they had forgotten him. Now, as the accumulated bitterness came out, finally his mother noticed he was still standing there with the buttered bread in his hand. I want you to stay on the other side of the road right where you belong, she said to the boy. He belongs over here just as much as he belongs over there, his grandmother exclaimed. Russell's mother started to leave, but turned at the door and said, you can eat the buttered bread, but I don't want any jelly on it. Grandmother jabbed her knife into that jar and smeared the bread with a thick coat of jelly, all the time glaring at the child's mother. Eat it, she commanded. Russell waited until his mother marched out, and then he ate it while grandmother watched. He didn't dare not to. While Russell Baker learned about power struggles watching his mother and grandmother, Annie Dillard learned about humor as her mother raised her in the 1950s in Pittsburgh from an American childhood. There's a deer standing in the front hall, she told Annie one quiet evening. Really? No, said her mother. I just wanted to tell you something once without your saying, I know. Annie remembers her mother having surgery on one of her eyes. On the operating table just before she conked out, she said fearfully to the surgeon, will I be able to play the piano? Not on me, the surgeon said. You don't pull that old joke on me. And of course, the surgeon was supposed to answer, yes, my dear brave woman, you will be able to play the piano after this operation, to which Annie's mother would have replied, oh, good, I've always wanted to play the piano. Oldie but goodie. Annie Dillard wrote that her mother regarded the instructions on bureaucratic forms as a special opportunity. Do you advocate the overthrow of the United States government by force or violence? And after some thought, she wrote, force. She regarded children, even babies, as straight men. When her babies learned to crawl, Annie's mother delighted in buying them gowns with drawstrings at the bottom, because she could step on the drawstring without the babies noticing, so they would crawl and crawl and crawl and crawl and get nowhere. Unlike Annie Dillard's mother, the mother of the writer Mark Saltzman could play the piano. In fact, she earned money teaching piano in her home. In his book, Lost in Place, Mark Saltzman described how his mother embarrassed him. It was the 1960s, and 7-year-old Mark Saltzman wrote NASA asking for information about how he could become an astronaut. 3 weeks later, he received a very large manila envelope from NASA stuffed with color photographs. Mark began his astronaut training immediately. One of the pamphlets showed an astronaut tucked inside a cramped mock capsule. The text below explained that the astronauts had to get used to spending many long hours without being able to move. Mark decided to set a record for sitting still in a cramped space. He was sure this would get NASA's attention. He found a cardboard box into which he could barely fit. He drew buttons and gauges all over the inside of it and outfitted it with a blanket, a thermometer, an alarm clock, and a periscope made with two of his mother's compact mirrors. He set up the space photos from NASA against the wall so he could look at them through the periscope and imagined himself on a real mission. 7-year-old Mark Saltzman began his program by sitting in the box for half an hour, and he increased his time every day by adding 10 minutes. After a week or so, when he felt his determination waning, he started pointing the box towards the TV so he could watch through the periscope to counteract the boredom. I don't think he knew they didn't have television in space. He did this for several weeks, building up to more than 3 hours per session before the training came to an abrupt end one afternoon. That day, the alarm clock showed he had been inside for 3 hours and 5 minutes. Suddenly, he heard a pop and felt himself shift in the position. There was another pop, and this was a little longer and sounded more like something tearing. One taped seam of the cardboard box was opening. If it got any wider, the 7-year-old would lose all his air pressure in his space capsule. His body would inflate like a balloon, then freeze in the absolute vacuum of space. "Mayday, mayday," he shouted. "Mission control, we have a problem." "Mark, honey," his mother said, "I'm teaching now." Someone else said, "Where did that voice come from, Mrs. Saltzman?" "Oh, from that box over there near the TV. My son's in it." Young Mark turned the periscope around and saw, instead of the Earth or Moon or the limitless void, his mother giving a piano lesson in the living room, and her student was sitting on the bench, staring in his direction. "Oh, he's practicing to be an astronaut," his mother explained in a stage whisper. "He puts those pictures of the stars in front of the box and looks at them through his little periscope. He's been doing it for weeks." She looked toward her son. "Mark, I think your box is starting to fall apart. Your rear end is sticking out." Her student giggled. Mark's butt had popped out of the spaceship right in front of one of his mother's teenage piano students. He pulled the toy periscope down, climbed out through the top, and carefully avoided looking at either his mother or her student. His face was red. He went upstairs to his room, lay down on the bed, and went into a black fog, which he descended into whenever he came out of an outstanding daydream and realized that he was still a little kid in Connecticut. Perhaps one or more of these stories has stirred up some memories in your own childhood. Like Frank McCourt, perhaps you recall your mother rushing to help you, or one of your brothers or sisters was injured. Or like Tobias Wolf, perhaps you recall getting your mother to do you favors when she was vulnerable. And like Eileen Simpson, perhaps you recall your mother struggling to help you in school. Or like Russell Baker, perhaps you recall watching your mother argue with other adults in the family. Like Annie Dillard, perhaps you recall your mother's use of humor. Or like Mark Saltzman, perhaps you recall your mother embarrassing you in front of a stranger. None of these mothers was perfect, but each of them did their best. This is what families are like. Children accidentally cut themselves, exploit mothers when moms have weak moments. Mothers want their children to do well in school but do not always know how to help them. Mothers argue in front of their children. Mothers make sarcastic jokes children don't always understand. And mothers do embarrass us in front of others. But still, most moms are good enough mothers. In spite of their imperfections, moms convey their love in 1,000 ways. We remember a hug and a kiss when they put us to bed at night. We remember the meals prepared each day so that we would not go hungry. We remember words of thanks when we brought home a small gift that we made at school for Mother's Day. We remember a look of pride when we passed the 8th grade or high school or college. And we remember a smile when after we left home and we returned to visit. We remember these moments and we celebrate our imperfect mothers, but good enough mothers. If they are still living at this time of year, we say thanks to our mothers, and we hope they are pleased with their imperfect children. Our closing hymn today is hymn number 159. Please rise if you are able. Please join me in the words in the order of service as we extinguish the chalice. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we meet again. Go in peace and return in love. Blessed be. Thank you.